Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, two more elections, one in the UK and one in France, give us clues about the future of Europe and if geopolitics with the United States and the rest of the world may change. We'll explore what may be in the global political forecast.
But first, is the U.S. State Department using its diplomatic efforts to push genetically modified foods into other countries? Our next guest says yes. Dr. Jadira Martinez-Pantoja joins us now. Her PhD thesis traced the United States' multi-pronged efforts to persuade Mexico to allow genetically modified foods. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you here. You've been studying the change in admitting genetically modified foods into Mexico, really by the persuasion of the United States. I wonder if you could start us with what was Mexico's policy before all of this persuasion?
At the advent of GMOs, Mexico was not aware of what was happening with biotechnology and what GMOs were. So it really started to follow some steps that the United States was following. But then Mexico realized that it was kind of dangerous because it's a new technology. So it adopted a strict regulation in which GMOs were not accepted and only were allowed at a very little experimental phase. And the government promulgated a set of regulations to control those experiments. So that's what happened before 2005.
Yeah, they used, I think, the precautionary principle, right?
That's correct.
Explain the precautionary principle for people who don't know.
So precautionary principle, it means that because you don't know what are the effects of this technology, you have to be very precautious about this and take measures so you don't allow new technologies or new events to come into the country. This approach was restrictive and no cultivation or commercialization of GMOs was allowed in Mexico.
And the concern was what?
The concern was that GMOs may contaminate native species in Mexico. The main concern in Mexico is maize because there's a lot of races and varieties in Mexico that they don't exist in some other parts of the world. So environmentalists and government officials were concerned about protecting those biodiversity in Mexico.
And so that started to change when?
That started to change in 2005 when the government promulgated the law on biosafety of genetically modified organisms, in which cultivation, commercialization, and experimentation with GMOs is allowed. Furthermore, this law promotes biotechnology and encourages scientific institutions and agencies in Mexico to promote biotechnology.
So then what you studied was really what you called public diplomacy. And you and I were just talking about, well, is public diplomacy just a different version of public relations? And this is particularly the role of the United States in pushing these GMO, genetically modified foods, into Mexico's public policy to make it more permissive, right? So let's walk through some of the things that happened. Maybe we start with who the various players are, who the actors are. There was the United States departments, so we'll walk through those. Then there are the corporations, and then there are nonprofit organizations. Tell us who these various actors are and what roles they were playing in this kind of battle to change Mexico's policy.
Okay, in this model of public diplomacy that I chose, it was because the GMO issue, it's a domestic and international issue at the same time with different forces acting together. So in the case of international actors that had an effect on this change of policy were the Department of State and also domestic agencies that are intended to work inside the United States but are also having effect and working outside of the country. In this case, the Department of Agriculture and the Foreign Agricultural Service, which have offices at Mexico City, and they are there with the objective of helping business people to make businesses in Mexico or in the United States. So we have these state actors from the government. And then also this persuasion is complemented by multinational corporations. In this case, the biotechnology companies are just six big ones, and including Monsanto and Bayer. And in the case of the non-governmental organizations or non-profit organizations, I identified the main global NGOs that are having campaigns to prevent the adoption of GM foods in the United States and also in Mexico and around the world. So these NGOs are mainly Greenpeace and ETC Group.
ETC Group, what does that stand for?
Erosion Technology and Corporations.
So Greenpeace is opposing the GMO, right?
Yes.
What about this ETC Group?
ETC also opposes to GMOs.
Also opposes. Yes. So they're the two primary oppositional groups.
Yes, correct.
That you were following. And the companies, you mentioned Monsanto. Are there other big corporations involved in all this?
Dow, BASF.
There was one that you mentioned, AgriBio. What is that?
Yes. These biotechnology companies are very smart, and they are making industry groups. So they associate together in industry group, and these industry groups represent them in front of the government and for in front of the public. So they look more friendly to people, and these organizations like Agro, Bio, or Bio, in the case of the United States, are organizations that promote biotechnology and all the advantages that this technology may have. So Bio, that is the main organization, has different representations all over the world.
In
the
case so it's of, a lobbying group, essentially, right?
Yes, advocacy that's correct. Group, yes.
Right. And PR. So they do PR, they do advocacy, lobbying to governments to promote genetically modified foods.
Yes, that's correct.
And AgriBio, you said it's the umbrella organization that represents all these, Monsanto and all of the others.
Yes.
Okay. And they were very active in Mexico in getting this policy changed.
Yes.
Maybe we should walk through how some of this happened. I was interested in learning about grants and research centers and these ways that you don't really think about when you think about the lobbying and the persuasion that goes on to governments. Can you tell us about some of these methods that these companies and the U.S. government used to persuade?
Sure. In the case of the biotechnology companies, they use different instruments such as opening research centers. So through these research centers, they promote research, and also they are promoting biotechnology. They invite scientists to these centers to participate and obviously leave their knowledge in there. They also use grants and awards. So people that is working in the field of biotechnology and that people that identify the advantages and the good virtues of GMOs is the people that is going to be awarded with these grants.
If you were a scientist and you were studying the harms of genetically modified foods, would you not get any grant money?
Not really.
No, you wouldn't. Okay, and then what about like one of these research institutes? Would you be employed if you wanted to look at the problems of genetically modified foods?
No, not really. And also, if you're a journalist and are documenting and writing some of these disadvantages, you're not going to receive that award.
Walk us through some of that, like what you found.
I found this article from a person that has the same surname as me, Pantoja. And she was writing about the new trends, applications, and promises of biotechnology. And she says that although NGOs mention that this can be a threat to the environment, there are more advantages of using GMOs. So she received an award for best article from a journalist, something like that.
Did you actually find journalists who were looking at the other side that were shunned or from their organizations?
No, but those kind of journalists never really win a grant or something.
Yeah. In terms of the government agencies, all right, so you mentioned the Office of Agriculture. These are the U.S. ones, right? Office of Agriculture, Biotechnology, and Textile and Trade Affairs. Are these all connected to the State Department, the U.S. State Department?
Yeah, this Office of Biotechnology and Textile is under the Department of State's jurisdiction. And this office is intended to promote and change the perception about biotechnology. So I interviewed an official government from this office, and he mentioned that they don't really want to promote specifically any product, but when they are giving speeches or they go on talks overseas, they just mention biotechnology once. However, when I did my research before meeting him, the website of this office explicitly said that the main objective of this office was to change the perception of biotechnology.
To make it seem safer.
Yes, and more helpful for farmers.
Altogether, this is really essentially the U.S. government trying to change the laws of other countries in order to support corporations.
Not really changing the laws, but changing the perception. And changing the perception among policymakers. So if you change the perception among policymakers, they're going to change the laws.
One of the most important aspects, I thought, in your PhD thesis had to do with long-term relationship building. And it seems like this is one of the most important parts of persuasion and lobbying advocacy. How did they do this?
So, for example, the Department of Agriculture to the Foreign Agricultural Service in Mexico City has different programs that help to build relationships in the long term. So, for example, they have a program that it's called Farmers to Farmers. In this program, they bring farmers from Mexico to the United States and they exchange information. And these farmers in the United States can be farmers that are cultivating GMOs or not cultivating GMOs. So they exchange information. And obviously, this program is also sponsored by the Soybean Council, for example, that it's pro-biotechnology. And then it's to change the perception among the farmers that GMOs are really a good choice. So after they go to the United States and they go back to Mexico, they still exchange information and they chat about how your cultivation is going and stuff like that. So Foreign Agriculture Service becomes like a mediator and like the link between these farmers. So in the long term, they're still exchanging communication. They can also ask for a specific course about biotechnology, for example. So that's another instrument that they are utilizing. Different courses, exchange programs, and
so this actually gets the farmers to put pressure on the policymakers.
Yes, because when they go back to Mexico and they change their perception, they feel like, oh, we need this new technology in Mexico. So they talk to directly to policymakers and in order to have a change in the regulations.
What about these nonprofit organizations like you mentioned, Greenpeace and
BTC?
Yes. How have they tried to argue against the inclusion of genetically modified foods in Mexico?
So these groups also have different instruments. For example, Greenpeace also uses lobbying with the government to convince them that GMOs are not a good option. So they also disseminate information, printed publications in which they include the disadvantages of adopting GMOs or the possible harms that it can have to human health or the damage to the environment. So these groups disseminate information, printed publications, and also make protests. So this is a very powerful instrument in which they just go out and gather many people and they protest against GMOs, adopting GMOs. And they have large posters.
But they really lost in this case.
Not really.
No.
No, not really, because with the new law on 2005, GMOs were accepted in a case-by-case basis. But when these NGOs realized that maize was under threat, they set up a lawsuit.
And the one against Monsanto?
Or? Yeah, Monsanto and the Secretariat of Agriculture of Mexico.
They filed that lawsuit what year?
2008.
And what's happened with that lawsuit?
So with that lawsuit, GM maize is not allowed in Mexico still. And recently, in 2014, they also filed a lawsuit to stop the cultivation of GM soy in the peninsula of Yucatan because this cultivation is affecting the production of honey. So they stopped this cultivation of GM soy in Yucatan. So they're really having an effect because they have gathered many people, they lobby, they disseminate information.
And it's information that's counter to what the research centers are finding, it sounds like. So you've got these smallish compared to big government and big business finding information that is counter to all of these government-funded, corporate-funded research centers that are all saying it's safe.
Yes, because these organizations don't have the same amount of money that the big corporations have, but they do independent research and also use independent scientists to document their findings.
Mexico, it sounded like from what I gathered from your work, is increasingly adopting these genetically modified foods with few exceptions. Is that also a problem of access? Access to policymakers, access to really have face-to-face discussion?
Yes, you're correct. That is because of access and resources. So they have some victories, as they call them, at a local level, but they don't have access to big policymakers, or they don't have access to the president. And in Mexico, the president is very important because this is a very hierarchical government. So the president almost mandates everything. In the case of the multinational corporations, they have access to the president. So that's why it's easier to have an influence over these regulations. In the case of NGOs, they don't have this and they don't have more resources to make more protests or more publications or more lobbying in general.
Let's talk about the structure in the Mexican government. You mentioned that they don't really have strong enough regulatory bodies to deal with this in your thesis. You also mentioned that they were patterning some of their bureaucracy after the United States bureaucracy so that there would be a harmony. Talk us through the government and why it matters.
For Mexico, it's very important to be harmonized with the United States because of the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. So for Mexican policymakers, it's very important to be aligned to the regulations of the United States. So in the case of Mexico, he was adopting like the same structure of the United States. In the case of the United States, when GMOs were born, the United States created the biotechnology framework in which the Department of Agriculture, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Food and Drug Administration are the ones that decide what GMOs are going to be released into the environment and are going to be used for food. So Mexico followed the same example, and it has the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Environment, and the regulatory body for food that authorizes the GMOs that are going to be released or going to be authorized for human consumption. So they follow the same pattern, although at the beginning for Mexico, the regulation was more strict and it really didn't allow GMOs. And now, especially the Department of Agriculture from the United States and from Mexico, they share a lot of information about biotechnology, new trends, new regulation, because it's very important to be harmonized and have the same sort of approvals because it's easier to make business.
What period of time were you looking at this?
It was a little bit from 1991. Then in 2005, it was the biggest change because of this new law. And then also in 2009, there was a new change on the law because Mexico was supposed to be the center of origin for diversity for corn. But in 2009, from the 32 states that there are in Mexico, only 8 states were recognized as centers of origin for corn. So that's another important point of time in Mexico, in which I focus in my research. And why did this happen? Because the president of Mexico had chat or some communication with the CEO of Monsanto. So that's why this is an important point of time for my research.
Some of this happened then during the Bush administration, and some of it happened during the Obama administration. And so under the State Department, especially the latter one, this was occurring under Hillary Clinton as well. Did you get a sense that it was the same policies out of both administrations? 2005 being George Bush, State Department, 2008 being Obama, State Department. Same types of policies?
Yes, mainly they are basically the same because one can expect that, obviously, Republicans promote businesses, but in the case of Obama, it followed the same trend on promoting businesses abroad. So, yes.
Do you think you'll look at this policy in other countries as well?
Yes, and we have the example of Brazil. So, in Brazil, GMOs were being smuggled, but now they are...
Smuggled by...
Some other countries in South America. So, the farmers bought in the black market the seeds and then planted in Brazil because... They didn't have regulations for that. But now they're changing the regulations and they're accepting and planting GMOs openly, and they are in negotiations with Monsanto for bringing this technology.
Are there positives for the farmers for some of these GMOs? Does it yield more crop, for example?
It depends, because if we take a look at the United States, and GMOs were designed for the fields of the United States. So it really helps. They can have higher yields. But in the case of Mexico, these GMOs are not very suitable because the design was different. So I'm not sure if it can fit for the Brazilian fields, but it doesn't matter because the important objective here is to sell more products overseas.
Yeah.
So yes, it can be also applied for Asia or the rest of Latin America.
And so that's going to be your next focus of research.
Yes, Latin America.
Yeah.
Especially.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Jadira Martinez Pantoja. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much, Maria, for inviting me.
Up next, two more elections, one in the UK and one in France, give us clues about the future of Europe and if geopolitics with the United States and the rest of the world may change. We'll explore what may be in the global political forecast.
Stay tuned.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Two more elections, one in the UK and one in France, give us clues about the future of Europe and if geopolitics with the United States and the rest of the world may change. We'll explore what may be in the global political forecast. We have three experts on Europe with us. Mark Amsler is with us. He is Associate Professor and Director of the Europe Institute at the University of Auckland. He's also the author of Affective Literacies. Jeroen de Wolf is Associate Professor in the Department of German. He's Director of the Institute of European Studies and Director of the Dutch Studies Program at University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of The Pinkster King and the King of Congo, The Forgotten History of America's Dutch-Owned Slaves, and Spirit of Resistance, Dutch Clandestine Literature During the Nazi Occupation. Patrick Chamorel is a senior resident scholar at Stanford University Center in Washington, D.C. He's the author of Aspirations in Reality, French Foreign Policy in the 2012 Elections, and the book chapter Anti-Europeanism and Euroscepticism in the United States. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. Thank you so much for being with us to talk about what's happening in Europe, what this all means. Most recently, of course, we've had the
election in the UK, it was quite a surprise for many people, both because of what the polls had said, and also I think there were some expectations. There was one article that just came out, I think today, Nate Silver on his blog, asserted that it's Donald Trump that is making Europe more liberal. Do you think that's a fair assessment? Jerome DeWalt, what do you think?
It's difficult to say. What we do see is that politicians in Europe that clearly are close to Trump are being punished as a consequence of that. So when Trump came to power, there was this uncertainty. Will this give a boost to populist movements in Europe, or will this rather have a negative effect on these movements? My feeling is that you clearly see a negative consequence.
And what do you attribute that to?
Well, I think the results so far obtained by the Trump government have not been very promising. My feeling is that there is more feeling now in Europe that if you want to punish, so to speak, the established mainstream parties, that opting for, you know, a populist alternative is maybe not, you know, the best strategy to do that.
Though, of course, there are cleavages within this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the UK, one of the blocks that made the difference was the youth vote.
Certainly. And of course, there's differences from nation to nation. It would also be dangerous to generalize and just look at what happened in the UK and France and then draw conclusions for the whole of Europe. The effect of the Trump election, for instance, on Eastern Europe remains to be seen. So all of that is still very uncertain at the moment.
Patrick Chamorel?
Well, there's no question that Donald Trump has been the biggest booster of Europe unity. I of course, don't include the UK in that picture, but for the rest of Europe, you know, there's been this flux of populism, and I agree that Trump has had some influence to deter people from voting for the populist movements. But certainly, you know, the three big influences on Europe today are Trump, Brexit, and the election of Macron. So Trump is up there for its influence on election outcomes, but also on policies that are shaping up for the near future.
If you were to go through each of those three and talk about how you see them shaping policies, what would you say they are?
Well, first of all, Trump, I think, obviously, is the one isolated from Europe, and that's his own doing. On Brexit, you know, he said that Brexit was the model for other nations in Europe to follow. And of course, it has been exactly, you know, the opposite, meaning that there is no other nation that is contemplating leaving the EU. And elections, as we've seen, has been tough on the populist movements. NATO, trade, the Paris Agreement on the climate. So Trump has really gone against everything that most, you know, that the mainstream Europeans believe in. And so Brexit obviously also has been, you know, kind of what we've seen in Britain is kind of a buyer's remorse. And of course, Macron is the most pro-European French leaders in a long time and one of the most pro-European on the European continent anyway. And he, not only did he defeat Marine Le Pen, who was of course, against the EU, but he also is really want to relaunch, you know, the European project around the Franco-German alliance.
Mark Amsler.
It's interesting that as we've been talking, the name Donald Trump keeps coming up when you talk about Europe. And I think that it speaks to the intense transatlantic volatility that's going on. It's not only the transatlantic, but particularly that. The election, though, in France in particular, seemed to me to be a weird kind of change because on the one hand, Macron is explicitly Euro-centered, European pro, right? And also radical, revolutionary in a sense.
How so?
In the sense of in terms of the political landscape, having pretty much we're seeing it in the parliamentary first round election, wiping out the socialists, wiping out Les Républicains, the traditional parties and so forth, and presenting an alternative, which is still in the center, right? But different. So people usually talk about the center in political terms as somehow a coalition, a merging of views, non-polarization, et cetera, et cetera. And yet it's wiping out something when presenting a different position within the center itself. The second round of the parliamentary elections should be really interesting in that respect in France, out of 577 seats. Exactly how many will be controlled by either En Marche or their Modem alliance, the Mouvement Democrat. The implications of that, though, are huge because he's very pro-Europe and he's pro-EU in a sense. But it does reestablish the, as Patrick was just saying, the Franco-German axis, so to speak. And that's huge. But they really are presenting somewhat different views on this because his notion of the Eurozone is not exactly the one that Merkel's been working through. She's been running the show, so to speak, because of the powerhouse that the German economy is and the presence that they've exerted, even if she didn't really want to in the first place. She's nonetheless been doing that. His proposals to revise the Eurozone, however, have worked on the premise of a collectivity. That is to say that the EU is a collective entity in which supersedes, so to speak, not everyone would agree with this, supersedes its 27 member states. So the idea of reworking the Eurozone around that will have a lot to do with people's sense of economic sovereignty and our debt versus your debt and the collective debt, who holds the purses for that. And that, we've seen that working out to the detriment of many of the smaller economies, not so small actually if you count Italy, in Europe over the last several years, Greece, Italy, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's a real tension that's building there that hasn't really been worked out in his proposals. And I'd like to see how that's going to – what will happen as a result. Will he deliver on some of these things or will he come, you know, make a strong move in that respect? And part of that will be, of course, how the parliament, you know, works out. But it still is a difference, even if it's in the center, so to speak. And I find that really interesting from the point of view of the idea of polarization in politics, as people have talked about on a fairly regular basis.
Would you agree with that, Jeroen de Wolf?
I would. Perhaps one word where I was a bit hesitant is the word radical that Mark used at one point.
Fair enough.
I would rather perhaps use the term realistic because you know, if you look at the shape of the French economy, you know, then you really have the feeling that the only way out for France is the EU.
When you say out, support, when
well, you out of the crisis, improve the economy, deal with unemployment. The only way out is the EU, and without German support, this won't work. In this respect, I think Macron is a very realistic politician, not a dreamer.
Patrick Chamorel?
Yes, I agree with most of what was just said, with a few caveats. Macron is kind of is not so radical in his inspiration. He is radical in the consequences of his success, which have marginalized, of course, the mainstream parties of the center-right and center-left. What's new, though, in Macron is that he thought that, you know, France can only move forward by bringing together the center-right and the center-left, and not majority on the right or the left, like was the case under Sarkozy and Hollande. And he made a very good case, I think, very convincing, one that even when you have a majority and maybe as not as big as the one he's going to have in a few days, but Sarkozy and Hollande had large majorities, things didn't move along. So I think what he saw that very clearly, and this is kind of a revolution, of course, in the Fifth Republic, which has worked, you know, polarized way between right and left. So it's kind of the Fifth Republic that he incarnates now, you know, in a very actually monarchical way, is seen, you know, what mistakes, for example, Sarkozy and Hollande have made. But of course, it's the Fifth Republic in style, but in the center, which is not exactly a staple of the Fifth Republic. So this is how he thinks that France can move along. And this is where, you know, the connection with Europe takes place, because he understands also that France will need Europe, that France will recover economically and in its political influence only through Europe. And that's also a very interesting notion, because so much has been said to the contrary. And so, yes, I agree totally with what was said about, you know, the contradiction between the federalist approach, and which is absolutely unusual, a federalist approach by the French leader, and a more sovereignist one by the Germans. So it's kind of the reverse of what we've been used to. And so that could, of course, raise problems. But these problems could be really minimized if France really reforms its economy. Mm-hmm. And this is what will basically open the gate to some move by the Germans on you know, running the Eurozone, etc. France has to, and Macron, therefore, you know, has to really show that he can reform the economy, starting with the labor market this summer.
One of the things that you had said in your earlier comments, Patrick, was about buyer's remorse on Brexit. And so I thought perhaps we should reflect a little bit on what just happened in the UK election. Now, again, the media have been portraying this as the word they use is catastrophic for Theresa May. Is that an exaggeration?
Well, I just think that the results of the referendum, which was a fairly ambiguous referendum with conservatives trying to argue for Europe, but the results of the referendum were fairly narrow. And yet, Theresa May went in the direction of the hard Brexit. And I think that, again, the election results itself was a problem, of course, for its opponents. But then, you know, when she decided to make it a hard Brexit, I think that lots of people realized that's not what they wanted.
Yaron, there's a lot of talk now about maybe she should go soft Brexit. And then, of course, Macron has even said sort of tacitly, well, you don't have to leave. What do you see here?
Well, what I also find interesting about these results is if you look at the two parties that were strongest in their opposition to Brexit, you look at the Liberal Democrats and the SNP, the Scottish Nationalists, they didn't win either, right? So the result of the election is not a no to Brexit. It's much more a yes to a soft Brexit, right? And that's, I think, an important observation. But that will be difficult to accomplish, of course.
And in terms of Jeremy Corbyn,
it's, of course, very surprising that, you know, we all expected a dramatic loss of the Labour Party. That did not happen. One could, I think, use the argument in favour of a soft Brexit as an argument that, you know, could explain why Corbyn did it much better than expected. One could perhaps also highlight the fact that what we have seen in recent elections is that people increasingly seem to like authenticity when it comes to political leaders. Even people who might disagree with Corbyn and his ideas, they might at least acknowledge that he's, you know, genuine and honest and authentic in his personality. So that might also have played an important role here.
Mark Ampsler.
I'd take a slightly different approach to the British snap election. I think what's been said is true. And the comment about the Lib Dems and the Scottish National Party being effectively, you know, reduced, not eliminated, but reduced, is a significant moment because it doesn't reflect on the Brexit. It's not a re-Brexit vote because other things were in play. And I think this is where the notion of Corbyn's authenticity, his sincerity, frankly, his just bloody-mindedness about key issues that were home issues, the reduction, the loss of a functioning social services profile. Public services weren't working, haven't been working in the UK for some time. The loss of funding for key medical, education, welfare services, and so forth. People really are hurting, right? And that's been quite clear. And he spoke directly to that. That was one thing. The other one was that it was a kind of general. It wasn't for the EU, quite the contrary. I mean, Labour wasn't exactly on the, you know, let's stay in the EU side, but rather an anti-austerity vote. And I think that he pushed on that again and again and again. How he would have delivered is another matter, because we have to remember, despite all the rhetoric and all the new narrativizing of the election, the Conservatives are still in government. They're in government with a very strange 10-member coalition with the Northern Irish Democratic Unionist Party. But nonetheless, that did change the feeling. And I think people voted in those terms, on their feeling, on their guts. And they responded to someone who said, look, this is the way things are. Look around you. And we can do better than this. And his message of better, I think, really took hold. The turnout from youth voters was huge relative to the previous elections, previous two elections. The Conservatives haven't had a majority in government, an outright majority in five of the last six elections. They've always been on tenterhooks. They've always been on the edge in this cycle. And I think that they continue to be in that position. May is clearly in a much weaker position. Everybody has said that. That's not news. What I find interesting, going back to the European Union, is that within the Brexit committee, or whatever the correct term is for that, the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, is starting to publicly argue for staying in the customs union. And that's a huge change, and it speaks to the soft Brexit, hard Brexit issue. But a huge change in the public profile of what they're going to do when talks open next week, actually, for the first time, if they, in fact, they, unless they postpone them. So this is a whole new sort of profile and agenda in the making, partly being made publicly by floating balloons and seeing how people react, but also directly in response to the vote, the last election, and the fragility of the Conservatives' control of the situation. I think, frankly, they don't have control of the situation. And we sort of knew that before because the 27 member states weren't exactly going to roll over and say, sure, do what you want, as far as Brexit is concerned. But that's even more the case now with Macron's momentum. The idea of European solidarity is, as we've been saying, is huge. And it's not just the economic solidarity of the European Union, but a sense of Europeanness. And Britain has suffered, I think, because of that.
There was an opinion piece in the New York Times, I think I forwarded it to you, Mark, about Macron's approach to the European Union and whether or not that might be disastrous for the Eurozone. Did you think that there was a disaster looming, or was this, again, media exaggeration?
I'm speaking now from the point of view of some of the research that's been done in the Europe Institute here at the University of Auckland, not by me, but by my colleagues, the economists and the finance people and so forth, who do research on the European Union in particular. And their feeling is, you know, the story has been that Germany's been carrying the bag, right? That Germany has done things that have both made the German economy a powerful engine within Europe, but they've also been holding the bag for everybody else. And Macron's proposal about the Eurozone and redoing the notion of the Eurozone and a budget for the Eurozone and things like that has gotten people quite flustered. One of the things at issue is, with all of this initiatives, with all of this newfound EU spirit, if you want to put it in those terms, whether the European Union as a political continental entity can actually do some of the much-needed reforms that they need to do. They haven't been doing them. They've been quite lackadaisical about this. And I think both economically as well as politically. And the extrication of the UK from the EU is one whole bag of problems. But on the other side, the European Union itself needs, you know, serious reforms. And he's proposing some. But it would mean a sense of collective responsibility and not sort of individual fighting within member nation states over the whose part of the purse is being most affected. We still have a very strong north-south divide in Europe. We've seen that over the last several years exacerbated economically. We've also seen now a new initiative from France that counters to an extent Germany's weight in European decision making. And at the same time, there's Brussels, right? That's, you know, nominally speaking. That is to say, they have, you know, what happens with the European Union as a political entity and the reforms. I think that's where I would like to see, I would suggest that Macron's momentum really be directed, not at the Eurozone per se, not just economically, but at the whole passel of issues that need attention in the European Union to make it through, say, the next 20, 30 years.
Mm. Jerome de Wolf?
What I would like to add is that I very much agree with Mark, but at the same time, I think it's also important to underline that reforms should not come just from the EU itself, it also should come from the nation states. And what really concerns me at this moment, you know, we have this wave of optimism at the moment. When you look especially, I would say, at the case of Italy, I am very concerned about the state of the economy in Italy and about the upcoming elections. And I don't think we can be all certain that Italy will remain a stable country after these elections. It could well be that populist parties come to the power, and then we have a whole new situation.
So you think the populist parties may come to power in Italy because it's suffering more than the other European countries? Is that what you're suggesting?
Because this is a broader discontent. Because the EU is not seen, at least that's the way I perceive it, it's not seen as a possible solution here, but rather as the cause of the problems that the country is facing, especially also the situation of the economy. It's disastrous. If Italy gets out of control, then we have a whole different situation than what we had with Greece, because the Greece economy was small enough, you know, for Germany to be able to control things. But if the same happens in Italy, then we have a whole different situation.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, because this idea that somehow Europe has dodged the nationalist bullet or something like that is, I think, a total misrepresentation of what's going on. And Italy, I could be wrong, is it the fifth, sixth largest economy, fourth? I can never get the numbers right. But one of the largest economies in Europe, and at the moment, the most unstable. So a lot hangs on that. And the fact that nationalist, populist parties and candidates are getting a lot of traction, and also in Eastern Europe as well, obviously in Hungary and Poland, et cetera, et cetera. This hasn't gone away by a long shot. So I don't think that people should be, complacent about it. And the economic instability of Italy is at the center of this. Now, though, I think the French-German alignment, not literally, but in terms of the structure of Europe, gives some chance for maybe keeping Italy more on track. But as we were saying, it still comes up to individual nations to do it. It's not just the EU as the super entity. The individual nations themselves have to participate.
Patrick Chamorel?
I tend to agree with this. There is clearly a very positive momentum because of Macron's election and because in the background of Brexit and the Trump election. But the problems, of course, are just as formidable as they've always been. And populism, might very well come back to some countries beyond Hungary and Poland, and Italy is a good candidate for that. And the refugee crisis itself, which hits Italy foremost, could also come back, and it hinges just on Turkey, basically, to a great extent. And Turkey, we're just a blackmail away from revisiting that the worst of that refugee crisis. So economically, as well as culturally, and for issues related to immigration, I think Europe might has a new momentum, but most of the problems are still around.
Given the direction of the United States moving to essentially a far right with, the Congress, the courts, 30 states, the presidency, and Europe seeming to reclaim its central position, do you see a change in the alignment coming in terms of geopolitics and security agreements, economic agreements? What do you think on that, Patrick?
Well, no, I think that it's very, there's obviously major tectonic changes here. On NATO, I think that the Europeans are very keen to reinforce their defense. And not just the means, the resources that they put into defense, but also to try to shape a European defense policy. Of course, it's a long running kind of dream, but it might take some more gain some more substance on trade. Also, I think that obviously Europe and the United States have some divergence with Trump. And on the climate. So I think, yes, that what we've seen is basically most of the European, at least, break with Trump, or rather Trump breaking with them. And the only ally to some extent of Trump being Theresa May. But yes, as we've seen, on trade and on the climate, Europe is now consolidating its ties with China, with India, with other countries, and that's not good for the transatlantic relationship.
Jeroen de Wolf, how do you see the geopolitics now?
Maybe what I could add to what Patrick just said is that we should be careful also to make conclusions about Europe and forget an important division when it comes to the transatlantic alliance between Western Europe and Eastern Europe. I think Eastern European countries are much more aware that in an emergency situation, the only country they can rely on for their protection is the United States. There is really no alternative to them. And I think that's, especially when it comes to Eastern Europe, that's a crucial point that we shouldn't forget.
So how many countries in that bloc that you would say Eastern Europe would contain?
I would say all of them, because they're all very much aware that you can't trust Russia. And that reaching out to China or whatever is not going to bring any solution here. So I think they're much more realistic than Western European countries, especially when it comes to defense, that Europe does not have an alternative at the moment. And with Brexit and the UK leaving the EU, I think Eastern European countries are even more aware, you know, how important it is to keep that alliance with the United States.
And so given the relationship seeming to shift a little between the United States and Russia, does that affect the Eastern European countries' attitude?
Well, there's, of course, uncertainty and concern. But at the same time, as I really want to stress, it is clear to Eastern European leaders that there is no alternative.
Mark Amsler, what would you say?
Well, that presents a real dilemma, doesn't it? Because on the one hand, I think you're right. That is, in terms of military force, there is no, you know, European military force as such. The United States is the backbone of the NATO agreement with respect to the Eastern European nations, from Lithuania and Latvia all the way down to Hungary. At the same time, some of those countries, in particular Hungary and Poland, are making great overtures and becoming more in alignment with a Trump administration, which itself is casting doubt on whether NATO is really a useful and important source of defense. So you've got sort of contradictory messages floating around in here. I think in terms of real politics, when push comes to shove, you're right, the U.S. is the only game in town. The other side of it, though, is that I think that Europeans in general, that is to say the European enterprise or the European project, has more allies around the world than it thinks it does, or it used to think it did. That is to say, there's a substantial portion of the United States, if it's not actually in government per se, or at least in the central government, is nonetheless very much in sync with European values, with your planetary thinking, collective responsibility, and so human rights and so forth. Likewise, China, no great savior of human rights, as far as I'm concerned, nonetheless has stepped in, seeing in their own self-interest in part, but also as a leader in aspects of climate change and foreign aid in particular, reaching out and so forth. Again, partly self-interested, but also working in the globe in a way that they haven't in the past. I think that there's more connections going on there than have been visible in the past. And it'll be interesting for me to see how that plays out over the next several years in terms of new alignments that occur. And regardless of what happens in the United States, I wouldn't say far right, frankly, but definitely moving in a rightward direction, and increasingly so, that other issues with respect to what kind of an exit if the UK, in fact, makes. If they say in the customs agreement, for example, with the EU, that changes the notion of trade agreements, the kind of thing that Theresa May was talking about, all these new trade agreements that would make the UK another global economic power and so forth and so on. Those are all, you know, relatively moot then, because that's not how the customs agreement works. So that affects places like New Zealand, right, for example. At the same time, I think that there's a growing sense of the youth, you know, there are generations coming up now, and they're voting, and they're making their voices heard. And I think there's a powerful kind of change working there, which over the next decade may in fact change the political landscape entirely in Europe.
Final thoughts: changing the landscape entirely in Europe, or a little bit more, a little bit less of the same? Patrick Chamborel?
Well, I think yes. I think the change it cannot be underestimated. You know, the change brought about again by these three events, you know, the Brexit, Trump, and Macron. I think that Europe will want to present a different face of itself. I think led probably by Merkel or by Martin Schulz, but probably Merkel and Macron. And that, you know, they will try to work on converging policies, especially in the Eurozone, if they can. As for Eastern Europe, yes, I completely agree that there is a fundamental contradiction between, you know, the cultural aspect of the drift, if you want, of the Visegrad countries, mostly Poland and Hungary, and on one hand, and their, you know, security interests. Culturally, you know, they feel actually, they feel close to Trump or even to Putin, and strategically, of course, their interests are not with Putin, obviously. So I think that, and I would add that this, you know, cultural aspect also work against, you know, the cohesion of the EU and with the place of these East European countries within the EU, since they are criticizing the form of democracy that is prevalent in Western Europe, for example.
Final thoughts, Jeroen de Wolf?
I think I can say that I agree with Mark, who ended with this optimistic outlook and highlighted that, you know, we have a younger generation coming up, a generation that seems to be much more in favor of an EU, of an identity that goes beyond the nation state. At the same time, you know, we have seen that there's still lots of concerns to be dealt with. We have the case of Italy. We have elections coming up in Austria, and the possibility that the far right will come into power in a coalition government with the Christian Democrats. We have the uncertainties with the Trump administration, where, you know, policy changes on a daily basis, essentially. Russia remains a very unstable partner. So, you know, there's lots of challenges coming up. But I think in general, I can say that the election of Macron clearly gave the EU a new momentum. And it would, of course, be wonderful if somehow this momentum could lead, perhaps that's wishful thinking, to a possibility to avoid Brexit and to go back to the negotiation table and see if perhaps some concessions could be made to the UK and Brexit could be avoided. But that might be too much wishful thinking.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for your time and for your thoughts and for sharing the research from your respective centers and institutes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you, Jerome and Mark.
Thanks, Pat.
Mark Amsler is Associate Professor and Director of the Europe Institute at the University of Auckland. He's also the author of Affective Literacies.
Jeroen de Wolf is Associate Professor in the Department of German. He's Director of the Institute of European Studies and Director of the Dutch Studies Program at University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of The Pinkster King and the King of Congo, The Forgotten History of America's Dutch-Owned Slaves, and Spirit of Resistance, Dutch Clandestine Literature During the Nazi Occupation. Patrick Chamorel is a senior resident scholar at Stanford University Center in Washington, D.C. He's the author of Aspirations in Reality, French Foreign Policy in the 2012 Elections, and the book chapter Anti-Europeanism and Euroscepticism in the United States. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.